And because I've known Lori for a long time. And we go back to when I was a GSR and a DCM, and we were meeting at assemblies, and we became friends then. And Lori has stayed at our house, and we've stayed at Lori's house back and forth in Nanaimo. So it's always fun to be with somebody that you've known for a long time. And Lori said she was a bit nervous, and I said, well, all you have to do, the secret of this whole thing is, behind the podium where they can't see you, you just put kitty litter on the box down there and you stand in it. So when you wet your pants, nobody really knows. So Lori didn't bring the kitty litter, but she's got the cat. Somehow the message got mixed up like it usually does in Alcoholics Anonymous. But we're all here one day at a time staying sober. So my friend from Lori, from Nanaimo, is here with her cat.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Lori, and I'm an alcoholic. And this is Pipsqueak. Maybe I should just explain why she's here. She's been a little on the sickly side for the last few weeks, and she's taken medication once every 12 hours. So if I was going to be here for the weekend, I couldn't leave her at home, and we didn't know what to do with her today because we gave up the hotel room. So here she is, and she's kind of soothing right now, I'll tell you. So I'm glad to be here this morning. What a glorious morning it was getting up this morning and being sober and knowing I'm coming here to be with a lot of friends. And I woke up in the hotel room this morning. We've got a great hotel room that's right on the waterfront. And I woke up this morning with a man in the room with me, and it's the same one I left home with last night. And I know his name. And I have this little kitten that's curled up beside me when I woke up this morning, and everything was beautiful. We looked out the window, and there's two bald eagles sitting on a rock right below our hotel room. And I'm sure if I spoke to Gerald that was here last night, he'd probably find some significance in that. I know it had some sort of spiritual significance for me this morning. So I'm really glad to be here, and yes, I'm really nervous, but I know I'm in a room full of friends, and God is in the room, and Roy and I said a little prayer together just before I started this morning, so I'm sure I'll calm down and be okay. So I guess I'll go back to the beginning. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic household. For about half the time that I lived at home, our alcoholic was drinking, and for about the other half of the time, he was sober. Other than a, you know, genetic, hereditary kind of a thing, I don't know how much that upbringing had to do with my being an alcoholic. But there's a few other things in my background that I think contributed to it and probably had a lot to do with where I went while I was drinking. So one of them happened when I was in grade 6, and like so many, or grade 1, I was 6 years old. And I hear so many people that get up to the podiums and talk about how they felt like they didn't quite belong when they were kids, and they, you know, they were never really comfortable in social situations, and I'm one of those people. I always felt like a bit of a misfit. And I remember in grade 1, I was standing out front of the school, and there was me and Geraldine was my best friend at the time, and her and I were standing on the front step, and there was another little kid named Martin that came along. And he was talking about going over someplace that they were all going, a whole bunch of kids were all heading to go and have fun. And he said, why don't you come along? And I just assumed when he said that he was including Geraldine and I both in the invitation. So I was all excited, and I said, yeah, let's go, Geraldine. And Martin turned around and looked at me, and he said, not you. You're ugly. And that defined me for almost the rest of my life. I didn't think, it wasn't just that I didn't belong. I had a reason for why I didn't belong and why I was being excluded. So from that point on, in my mind, I would never belong anywhere because I was ugly. And I have to realize that when I was a kid, I was skinny as a rail. I got my first pair of glasses before I went to school. They were bifocals, so they were thick like Coke bottle bottoms. So I was kind of a homely little kid. I was a geeky kid, too. I had a good head on my shoulders. And without even really much of an effort, I was an honor student in the lower grades. But this ugly thing hung around for so long. I'm sure you all remember the story of the ugly duckling. A story used to make me cry when I was a kid because I kept wondering when I was going to turn into a swan. And it just seemed like it was never going to happen. So that kind of set me up for being even more left out when I was a kid. So another thing that happened a little bit later, we were living in Courtney at the time, and my dad was still drinking. And it always seemed like, I don't know if this is, I'm sure there's other people here that had the ugly thing follow them around when they were kids. And it always seemed like the friends that I picked out were always really good looking. It always seemed like whoever my best friend was good looking, they were all perfect, and they attracted lots of attention. And because of that, I was always getting this not you, you're ugly thing, because they got the attention and I got left out. So by the time I was about 10 or 11, I think that's how old I was, my friend at the time was Linda, and we were as close as this, inseparable. We were coming home from the show one night. We'd been to the show in Courtney, and we were walking home. We took a shortcut through the railway station in Courtney. And we didn't know it at the time, but I guess there was some work being done on the tracks up there. And there were two rail cars that they were using like bunkhouses for the guys that worked on the tracks. So when Linda and I snuck through there to take a shortcut home, two of the men from the rail cars came out and stopped us on the road. And both, each one of them took on one of us. And, you know, the next thing I know, I had this man, an adult man, with his arms all around me and pawing me, basically. And all I heard was he said, "You're beautiful." So it never occurred to me at the time that there was anything wrong with anything that he was doing. All I knew was that I heard what I wanted to hear. So nothing was ever said to anybody. But in my mind, it told me that if I wanted to belong and I wanted people to think I was okay, I knew what I had to do that. Another time, I guess we moved out of Courtney when I was 12. My dad was sober by then. He took a job with BC Highways, and we moved down to Victoria, actually Duncan first. So I left all my friends behind, and Linda included, and they left all their AA friends behind. So it wasn't unusual for us to travel back and forth so Mom and Dad could visit their AA friends, and I always went along so I could visit my friends in Courtney too. On one of those trips, my dad was taking two newcomers to a meeting up in Courtney, and Mom went along to visit her Al-Anon friends. So Mom and Dad are sitting in the front seat of the car, and they had me in the back seat between these two newcomers. And once again, I found myself partway up. It was dark when we were driving up, and one of those guys decided that he was going to have his way with me in the back seat. And there again, he was all over me, and I heard those words again, "You're beautiful." And it never occurred to me that there was anything wrong with what he was doing. All I heard was what I wanted to hear. "You're beautiful." So, and again, it told me what I needed to do to hear it. So that stayed in my mind. And by the time I got to 13, when I discovered alcohol, alcohol did magic things, because it took away some of the uneasiness about being around people. It took away some of my conscience as well. And I knew what I needed to do to get the attention and to feel okay and to hear the things I wanted to do. Alcohol allowed me to do that. So throughout my drinking history, my mission in life was to do what I needed to do so that people would tell me I was beautiful. And to me, beautiful could be anything. It wasn't necessarily about the outside stuff. It was anything that made me feel like I belonged. So that's the way my drinking went. It was all about getting attention. It was about doing what I needed to do, what I thought I needed to do to get people to tell me what I wanted to hear. And I did that for years and years and years. So with that kind of a mental setup, my opinion of men wasn't too good, you can imagine, because, you know, as far as I knew, all they wanted out of me was the same thing. You know, and you know what that is. I don't have to go into details. So on I went in my merry way. Now, it's not to say that I was always, all the men in my life were abusive or that they used me or anything like that. There were good ones that came along. And once I got into my drinking, they really never had a chance to treat me well because I didn't know how to accept that anyway. So I had a few relationships that lasted for a couple of years, and there's nothing wrong with the men that were in those relationships. We were just too sick to know how to carry them on. So one of them is here tonight, actually. We had a relationship that lasted for 6 years. Nothing wrong with either one of us. We were good people, but we were both sick alcoholics. And he's here now sober, and I think that's magic. So I carried on my merry way. When he and I split up, I really went wild. And I mean, for a long time there, you know, I went through that stage with men were something that you used to get what you wanted. And all I knew, I had a hard time hanging on to a job when I was drinking. I wasn't very reliable. You know, I hardly ever showed up for work. I never phoned in when I didn't show up. So they could never count on me to show up. So consequently, I got fired a lot. Most of the jobs I had when I was drinking, I got fired from. So I never had any money in my pocket. And that always meant that I had to find somebody, you know, you have to drink and you have to find somebody to buy it. So part of the whole thing was I did what I needed to do to hear the stuff I needed to hear, to get the drinks I needed to drink, and whatever it took was what I did to get it. So eventually in all that falderall that I went through and that horrible lifestyle, and I don't want to go into any more detail on that, but eventually I stumbled across in my travels one of those people that likes to rescue lost things or broken things. So here comes this person, just to tell you how badly he needed to fix things. The night he met me, I had this big, fuzzy, blonde, afro kind of a hairdo, you know, big, 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 fuzzy thing, and a black eye. And I guess to him that meant this is the one for me. And he came along to try and rescue me. So, and he was very nice. You know, for the first time in my life, here's a person that tried to look after me to see that I was comfortable. He was forever, are you too hot? Are you too cold? Do you need this? Do you need that? He was really a very nice person. And I remember going to my friend at the time, her name was Maureen, another, you know, we were as close as this, inseparable. And I remember going to her when I first met him and I said, Maureen, I don't think I deserve to be treated this well. I mean, why should anybody treat me like that? And Maureen's a good friend, so her response was, she said, Lori, I think you more than anybody deserves to be treated well. So Maureen and I are still friends. I stayed with him. We actually stayed together for a long time. We were living together for 3 years in the last year of my drinking. I have to say I was never very good to him, in spite of the fact that he treated me well. He always treated me with respect. He was good to me. I used him for what I needed, and that was all. I really never did treat him very well. But he did eventually get too much of it. You know, there were days I didn't show up. I didn't get home at night. You know, we fought a lot. I know one night I got up in the morning, and I was, you know, coming out of a blackout drunk, so I didn't know what had happened the night before. But when I looked at him this morning, he had a great big bandage on his hand, and I wondered what had happened. He says, well, I smacked you in the head last night. I didn't even know what had happened. He broke his hand hitting me, but I didn't know what happened. And I'm sure I provoked it. I have no doubt in my mind. So one morning I woke up, and I was halfway down the hall. We lived in a mobile home. I was halfway down the hall, and there were carpet burns on my chin and my face. I don't know what exactly had happened. I didn't know if I was halfway down the hall because I was on the way to bed or coming out of the bathroom. I didn't know really what was going on because I couldn't remember anything. And I came to, and I realized when I came to that the house was cold and empty. And I got really, really scared. You know, here I had this person that had been kind of babysitting. He looked after me when we went out together. He got me home in one piece. He kept me out of the scrapes I would get into by myself. So when I woke up that morning, for some reason, I just knew I couldn't go on my own. And I was fortunate because, like I said, I grew up in a household where the alcoholic in our family sobered up when I was quite young. So when I reached that morning of hopelessness and despair, I mean, I can't describe how helpless I felt that morning. I was so lucky because all I had to do was call home. You know, I had a set of parents that were just waiting for that day to come. They knew I was in trouble all along. They knew they couldn't do anything about it. So they just sat and waited until the phone call came. So finally it came, and I picked up the phone, and I said, "Daddy, I think it's time." And he came over right now. There were several times in those last few years of my drinking that I called him at 4 o'clock in the morning. I would go on remorseful things, you know, crying jags while I was drinking, and, well, I better do something about my drinking, and I'd phone them at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and it didn't matter if he was working in the morning or what he had going on in his life. He dropped everything and came to get me. So I can only imagine what was going through his mind this time when I phoned and said, "Daddy, I think it's time." So, but this time I meant business. And I went to visit them. We talked about sobriety. We talked about getting sober. And I guess it was kind of a step one. I knew I was in trouble. I knew I needed help. I knew sobriety was the answer. I had the example to look to. So, and I was making the choice to do what I needed to do. But I was under the impression that all I needed to do was stop drinking, you know, and that was going to fix everything. So I struggled through those first days of sobriety, few days and weeks. I was fortunate that the partner I had at the time stopped drinking with me because he thought that might be helpful. Remember, he's a fixer, so he would do anything he could to help me out. So, and I did get sober. And it's really, you know, just with staying sober, it is amazing what kind of changes do happen. Not very much happened on the inside, but, you know, I started showing up for work because I wasn't drunk and I wasn't hungover. I was much more reliable, so I kept my job. Now, there was another reason why I kept my job, because the job I had when I sobered up was working for my partner's father. So I was kind of insulated in the last 3 years of my drinking from losing my job, because if he fired me, it chopped off half of the income to his son's household too. So that kind of kept me working when anybody else would have fired me. So here I am sober and I've got a job. The father-in-law-to-be ran a business machine company, and through him I took an interest in cash registers. I'd worked as a cashier in some of the, you know, 6 or 7 month jobs I'd had while I was drinking, and I took an interest in the cash registers. Well, went for about 5 months, and things had picked up so well. I was doing well at work. I was feeling good. You know, I had a solid income. I felt good about myself. So I thought everything was okay. So my partner and I decided, well, everything's going to be all right now. Let's get married. 5 months sober. And we got married. And it was actually a fairly good marriage for a few years. Like, it went along quite well for a few years. But I guess the problem is, I changed and he didn't. And my life took off in unusual ways. I mean, I couldn't believe some of the things that were happening to me in sobriety, especially where my work is concerned. His was staying the same. So he started getting kind of resentful at me for that. He was also resenting the fact that I still liked it that he didn't drink, because it did make it easier for me. And I guess on the side he was sneaking out to go drinking, and eventually he found somebody else that would drink with him. So the marriage did come apart. We actually stayed together for 8 years, but it did eventually come apart. But, you know, I think these people are put in our lives when we need them, and they stay there until we don't need them. I don't have any hard feelings towards him now. And the fact that we were together and I worked for his dad has set the stage for everything that's gone on in my working life since then. While I was still working for his father, and working with the cash register, I did the programming and all that sort of stuff on them and installed them. And we had a lot of people that came into the shop and asked about where he would go to get trained to use those things. And I didn't know. I said, well, check with the college or check with the manpower office or something like that. So one day, just for the heck of it, I phoned up to the college and asked them, you know, where you go to get that kind of training. And they said, well, we don't offer it, but we'd like to if we had somebody to teach it. So I said, well, I'd like to try. And I don't know where that came from. I've never done any kind of training or teaching or anything like that. I didn't have a clue how to do anything like that. But from somewhere out of my mouth came this, well, I'd like to try. One of those things you say and then wish you hadn't, you know. So they said, good, let's try it. So shortly after I sobered up, I started teaching these cashier training courses at the college in Malaspina, and in Nanaimo, and it took off from there. I've been doing it for just about 25 years now. So if I hadn't been in that situation and got that job and got started with the machines, that never would have happened. So back to the beginning of my sobriety. As I mentioned, for the first couple of years while I was still with that partner and while we were married, all I did was keep in touch with my mom and dad. They were sort of my security in staying sober, and it worked not too badly. Both of them had a lot of years in sobriety, and mom was a lot of years in Al-Anon, too. So they knew the program. They knew all the slogans. They knew the steps. They knew all that stuff. So it worked not too badly. But the problem is that was the only support I had in sobriety. So let me just put it all in the right order here. While I was doing my cashier training, I took contracts with some of the other colleges on the island, so I ended up doing a bit of traveling, and I found myself spending a week up in Port Hardy teaching. Now, you have to imagine that coming from never being able to hold on a job and sleeping under bridges and, you know, suicide attempts and psych wards and all that kind of stuff, to find myself with colleges that are phoning me and asking me if I'll come to work for them, my head got pretty thick, pretty big, and I was quite full of myself. So here I am up in Port Hardy. I'm making really good money. I'm better money than I've ever made. I'm in demand for the job that I'm doing, and I was just really, really full of myself. So I had this group of 18 women in Port Hardy who wanted to show me the town. So the Thursday night that I was up there, they had a ladies' night extravaganza in the bar at the Thunderbird Inn. I was 4.5 years sober at the time. And I thought, well, I didn't want to have them think that I was being aloof by not going with them. I really didn't want to go. But I decided I would go anyway just because I didn't want them to think that I was thinking myself better than them or anything like that. So I decided to join them. So I went into the bar at the Thunderbird Inn. For the first 3.5 hours while we were there, I didn't drink at all. I had grapefruit juice and 7-Up, and it seemed perfectly normal. I was sitting at a table with people, and I knew there was two or three of the girls at this table who had a connection with AA. I recognized the jargon and the slogans, and they weren't drinking. So I felt quite comfortable, and everything was okay. But they got up and left quite early, and when they did, I changed tables. And I went to the table that was drinking. And it took, maybe 10, 15 minutes after I got to the drinking table when a tray full of beer went by and I grabbed one. And I sat and drank for the night. Well, if I had known that was going to be my last drunk, I would have done a better job of it. I didn't get really falling down drunk. I didn't even really have a very good time. No, nothing very exciting happened. There was lots of men there, you know, after the strippers didn't show up, so that didn't happen. And when they didn't show up, they let all the men into the bar. Lots of them came in because the bar's full of women. And so, you know, I could have had a real good time. In the old days, I would have gone for a run with that. But for some reason, I didn't that night. I did drink, and I felt it. Anyway, so we finally left the Thunderbird Inn. These girls were determined that they were going to show me the sleaziest bar in town before I left Port Hardy. If there's anybody here from Port Hardy, you probably all know where that is. Seagate? Yeah. So that's where we were going. We were going to leave the Thunderbird and head for the Seagate. Now, this part of the night I cannot explain. When I came out of the bar at the Thunderbird, I could hear them all calling me. I wanted to go with them to the Seagate. I was, you know, already under the wind. I wasn't plastered, but I had been drinking by now. So as far as I was concerned, I was heading to the Seagate with them. And for some reason that I still can't explain, when I came out of the bar, instead of following them, I walked around the outside of the hotel and went back around to the lobby and went back up to my room. I could not get my legs to go where I wanted them to go. I wanted to go with them, but I just couldn't get my legs to do it. So instead, I went up to my room and I stayed there. So I have to conclude from that that something else took over at that time. So maybe the 4.5 years earlier when I decided I was going to get sober wasn't the right time. This time, something much bigger than me made the decision. And I couldn't undo it even if I wanted to. So that was my last drunk. It wasn't a very good one. Like I said, if I was known it was going to be the last one, I would have done a better job of it. And that was July 12, 1985. So that was the real beginning of my sobriety. Now, I still felt that my parents were still my grounding in the program. So if I needed help staying sober or if I felt shaky at all, that's who I went to talk to. And they were very good. We spent a lot of time together. I got to know them really well in those early days of sobriety. But that's all I had for support. Well, about 3 years later in 1988, Mom was diagnosed with cancer, and she died in March. And about 3 months later in June, my dad died very suddenly. So here I am in my second stretch of sobriety with no support other than the two of them, and all of a sudden they're both gone. And I seriously considered drinking. I thought about it, you know, I thought, you know, that the only people that really cared that I was sober were gone, so why bother? But for some reason instead, I went to an AA meeting. And I remember going, it was December, it took till December before I finally went to the meeting, and I remember going there, and there was a young fellow that was talking about having to go up to Quadra Island and spend Christmas with his mom. And he said he was dreading it, you know, like he didn't want to go, and they always fought, and it was so uncomfortable, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, geez, you know, I'd give my right arm to spend Christmas with my mom. So that was my beginnings in AA. I knew if I went there that there would be people there that cared that I was sober. And I was right. It is where you go. If you need people around you to support you, to remind you why you're here and why you're sober, they're here. And I found them. Now, I still had some of that old attitude that I brought into AA with me. I mean, right off the bat, I got involved with all sorts of stupid relationships. The very first time I went to a meeting, I was driving a Cadillac at the time, because, you know, we have to look good when we get here. And the first meeting I went to, there was me and several of the guys at the meeting that went out for coffee after the meeting. And they were all very impressed with this Cadillac, so they're all pushing buttons and playing around with things in the Cadillac. It had an electric sunroof on the top, so they're fooling around with all the buttons and they got the sunroof stuck open. So, and, you know, I guess there was four of them there. They started trying to fix the roof. So, yeah, you know what goes on, right? They had it all apart. The inside of the roof was all taken apart. So it's in pieces all over the place. It looked like an old wreck, and they didn't know how to put it back together. They didn't know how to get the roof closed, and it started snowing. So that was my introduction to AA, my first meeting. The first time I went was these guys taking my Cadillac apart. It cost me $700 to get the roof put back together. But I kept thinking at least they tried, you know. So I remember I went to the meetings for a few months, I guess 2 or 3 months, and the people were really nice. It felt like home, you know, all those things that everybody says. But I kept thinking, you know, I'm sober, I'm solid, I've got a good job, things are going well for me. You know, maybe I don't need to do this. And I mentioned it to one of those guys that was at that first meeting. He was one of these people that was in and out and in and out and in and out. He'd been around AA for years and never actually even got a year sober in. But he had good stuff to say anyway. And I told him one night, I said, you know, I don't really think I need to do this. Like, what am I going to get out of AA that I haven't already got? And he looked me straight in the face and he said, you know, maybe you should think about what you can put into it instead of what you're going to get out of it. And I felt like this big when he said that. I thought, you know, it never occurred to me that there was something I could put into AA instead of taking something out. You know, maybe it's not about me. Maybe it's about not get. Maybe I should give something instead of get. Because remember, I had AA in the background. I got here pretty easily with just a phone call home. So maybe I should start thinking about what I could do for AA. So I stuck around and I got involved in service work. And boy, I tell you, you learn anything you need to do to get through life getting involved with service work. It's been a blast right from the beginning. I did a lot of the jobs in the home group, cleaning ashtrays, sweeping the floor, chairing meetings and all that kind of stuff. That was the beginning. And I started feeling like part of the group. I had a really supportive big book group in Nanaimo that I was part of in the beginning. And I felt good, you know. I started learning things about how to deal with other people, you know, how to manage situations with group, how to cooperate with people. I'd never done that. So with all that social ickiness that I used to feel in groups, I started losing it by working in service work. Now, I can remember doing the rally committee in Nanaimo, and we had a couple of old farts that had been on their rally committee forever, and nothing ever changed while we were there. And I started with the rally committee tonight in Nanaimo. They made me the program chairperson, which meant it was my job to pick speakers. Well, I hadn't been around AA all that long, so I didn't really know any of the speakers. A couple people gave me tapes to check out, and I found a couple of tapes that I thought the speakers were great. So I went back to the rally committee meeting, and I said to all these old farts, well, I've got a couple of speakers. And they said, no, well, we think this lady should speak and that one should speak. And I said, well, why did you give me the job if you didn't want me to do it? So I got my way. I told them, you know, you gave me the job. These are the speakers. They're going to talk. So that was my beginning in the rally committee. I stayed with the rally committee for 8 years in Nanaimo and eventually chaired it. So now one of the other things that happened when I was chairing the Nanaimo rally, it was a good experience. About 25 years before I chaired the rally, my dad chaired the rally in Nanaimo. And he and a bunch of the other guys had gotten together and done a thing called Swain Lake. A bunch of them donned tutus and tights and the whole bit. And they had a local choreographer put a routine together for them to do a ballet at the rally. There was about 8 guys that did it. One of them was an ex-cop. He was about 6'6" or something like that. And they did it with the hairy armpits and the hairy chests and the whole bit. It was just a scream. So when I was the chair of the rally in Nanaimo, I decided that I wanted to repeat that performance in honor of my dad. So I put up posters in the Alano clubs and sent them around to all the meetings. I didn't know how I was going to get any volunteers that were going to be willing to put on tutus and tights at the rally. So I put up a poster and I said, you know, 25 years ago when they did it, you know, they did this thing and it was real popular. Everybody loved it. But I said, I think the men in the program were different in those days. And I said, I bet none of you got the balls to do it. So within about a week, I had about 12 volunteers. So we put this thing together. Now, the other thing that's really interesting, I had no idea where we were going to get tutus for men to do this dance. So, and at the time, I was doing my teaching around at the college, and one of the courses I worked on in Duncan, I had a girl in the course that was just opening up a business that was renting and selling dance costumes. So I, on one of the lunch hours, I mentioned to her, you know, we're doing this rally in Nanaimo, and we want all these men to do this thing with, you know, I told her about the one 25 years ago, and she says, well, that's really neat. She said, we just did the same thing with the Duncan firemen. I've got a whole box of tutus for men. So, you know, when you need it, it shows up. It was a lot of fun. We even got the original choreographer, one of the dance teachers in Nanaimo that had originally done the one with my dad 25 years before, came and did it again for us. And she thought it was a blast, too. So I'm really grateful to the guys from Nanaimo that did that. It meant a lot to me because it was in remembrance of the one that my dad had done. So a couple of guys in Nanaimo owe a big one, too, on that. So... Where do I go from here? It's funny, you know, when I was thinking about what I might say here, I go through all the old stuff and I can get to where I got sober and, you know, bits and pieces, and then I always go blank. I don't know why that is. So I'm not sure where I'm going from here. Service work. So I went through the usual stages of GSR and DCM. I did a term of 2 years as the secretary of the area. That was sort of a funny one too, because, you know, I felt like I should do something on the area after the DCM. I didn't know what it was. I didn't really feel very confident about doing any of the jobs. And when it came right down to it, I really don't like typing. I mean, I can, but I don't like to. So, and for some reason, I ended up putting my name up for the secretary position, which is just about all typing. So, and I wondered, why did I do that? Like, why volunteer for a job that involves doing something you really don't like doing? And I guess the answer, like, I didn't do that because I wanted to do it. I did it because that was the job I could do. And I felt like I should do something for AA. So I took on that job and did all that typing, whether I liked it or not. So, where do I go from here? I've been so blessed in the time that I've been sober. You know, I do my best to do the steps. I've gone through several step series, and with each one I go through, I peel off another layer. I'm surprised when I do four steps and fifth steps, you know, because, you know, we go in and look at ourselves, and every time I do one, I think I'm being 100% honest, but when I get to the next one, I'll do another one a year later, and I'll find out, well, gee, I was full of it the last time I did. Like, that all looks phony. And that happens every time I do it again. You know, I'll be really, really honest, I think, and then a year later, it looks totally different. So in my mind, that tells me that I have to keep doing it, because I'm getting a little more honest and a little closer to the truth every time I do it. And every time I go through the steps, I get a little closer to the truth. And I think I started out talking about the Ugly Duckley story because that was my favorite story when I was a kid. It still is. And I feel like it's my story, you know, because I started out that ugly duckling, and I always wondered when I was going to turn into a swan. And when I was a kid, I used to cry all the time because I thought, when is it going to happen to me? And I'm lucky because, you know what? Thanks to the God of my understanding in AA and the program that I've gone through, I'm getting to be a swan. And it's got nothing to do with the stuff on the outside. It's got everything to do with the stuff on the inside. The outsides didn't change, you know. I'm still not very happy with the outside stuff. But the inside stuff feels really good. And that's all because of the stuff I've learned from you guys here. You know, I've got good friends. Like I said, I've got this man in my life that treats me with love and respect, and all he demands is that I do the same thing for him. You know, and that took a long time coming. I used to think I was one of those people that they talk about in the fourth step that was incapable of forming a true partnership with another human being. I didn't know how to do it, but I'm learning. And I'm not perfect yet. I'm not a swan yet, but I'm getting closer. And every time I hang around, every time I keep going to meetings and I learn more stuff, I do service, I learn so much from service. It's done, made major, major changes in my life. I get a little bit closer to being the swan. So I'm going to hang around longer. I'm sure the swan's going to come yet. With the help of all of you, with the God of my understanding, I'm sure it's going to come. And I think I must have reached the end. I'm drawing blanks here, so it's probably the time I should shut up. Thank you all for being here, for all the friends that came here to support me. My sister is here. This is her first AA rally ever. And I know you'll all make a real welcome. Ed is here, the good man of my life. My sponsor's here. So who could go wrong with all of that? Thank you all for my sobriety.